Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why, episode 242. My chat with stand-up comic John Poveromo. But first, let's check out my sponsors, shall we? So our first sponsor is, of course, Audible. Get your free audiobook download and your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. The other day I went out holiday shopping, which for me is always stressful, but just like extra this year. So I decided to find something soothing on Audible to entertain me on my journey. I listened to Maria Bamford's You Are a Comedy Special. So delightful and sweet. Maria is so quirky and kind. It was just what I needed to keep me motivated to finish up my errands. You should check it out, and you can do that on Audible. Audible is available on most of the devices in your house, I'm sure of it. Go now and sign up, and then you can get your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Our other sponsor is PodcastCadet.com. Podcast Cadet is working hard to help people like you navigate the uncharted waters of podcasting. Let Podcast Cadet get you started. Ask Podcast Cadet for help with your existing podcast. I teach a webinar on PodcastCadet.com about being a better host for your podcast. Lots of good tips, and I play about 7 different characters throughout. A must-see for fans of me, which I assume you are. Check out what the Podcast Cadet community can do for you at PodcastCadet.com. Use code YBY20 when you contact PodcastCadet.com to get 20% off the first service or workshop you buy. This week on Yes But Why, we talk to stand-up comedian and political comedy writer John Poveromo. In our conversation, John and I talk about Robin Williams, 6th grade yearbooks, and how to go viral. I now present to you Yes But Why, episode 242. John Poveromo on working hard and knowing your own value. Enjoy. Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
I was like making up songs. I talked nonstop, much to their chagrin, because like they enjoyed it, and they talked to me or whatever, but whether it was funny or not, I was just throwing stuff at the wall hoping it would stick, even what most comedians do now, but as a kid, which is just, you don't know what's funny, you don't know when to stop, had a lot of energy, and yeah, I was always like that. Yeah, it was a weird, I loved funny, and my family was funny. They told stories, they got through, a lot of what they were going through with humor and stuff. So it was just, I watched it. So it was innate, and I wanted to be a part of it, and I wanted to do it, but didn't know how.
You didn't watch stand-up or anything, and that's what led you to be exploring random topics?
I must have been 4 or 5 the first time I saw a comedian, and believe it or not, it was Jack Mason.
Nice.
And it was because my grandfather loved entertainment. He was kind of involved in it a little bit when he was from England, jumped ship, met my grandmother, and then, got his green card and stayed and became a citizen or whatever. But he used to run his own business. He had a wig shop. Nice. And he did like Ella Fitzgerald's hair, and he would see these famous people every now and again. He was a little bit involved in like certain small movies and stuff, but he loved entertainment, so he watched Jackie Mason. It must have been, I was born in 84, so it must have been a special that he did in the 80s, because it was like a big deal. I know he taped it. I know I couldn't watch the whole thing, but he did an impression of Kennedy. I think it was Ted Kennedy. And And I used to repeat it all the time. Absolutely not, because it was everybody laughed at it. And he would say, "Yeah, Jackie Mason would go like, ebba bee bida bom bom bay. Oh, he never said that." And I repeated that as a kid, not knowing what it meant, not knowing what he did. But everybody else thought it was funny because there was this little kid doing a Jewish comedian's version of an Irish Catholic politician. So
everybody loves the Kennedy accent, man. Even in Boston, yeah. It's not what it sounds like, but.
Exactly. And it was always Mayor Quimby from The Simpsons too. So yeah, that accent was just around, and when I was a kid, I had no idea what it was. I just thought it was funny.
Oh man, that's so great.
And then the second comedian I ever saw, I was a little bit older, and it was when we were in Arizona. So I must have been like 10 or whatever. It was Richard Jenny, Crazy from the Heat. That was, and I have that exact special on VHS, because Richard Jenny was like one of my favorite comics. But when I was a kid, my family loved Richard Jenny, and that special in particular, because I think he filmed it in Phoenix, and we lived in Arizona for like 4 years. So that's another stand-up I saw.
Did you see him in person, or did you like see him on TV, or like get the tape?
No, we got the tape. I think somebody we knew saw him in person, went to see him, and then the VHS special from HBO came out on, you know, on tape or whatever, and we got the tape. And it was a big deal because we all would, you know, there wasn't anything to do. So we grabbed that, and I got to kind of be in the room and watch it.
That's great.
Probably shouldn't have been, you know, that special particularly wasn't overtly filthy. And there was like one whole chunk that he did about when you were a kid and your mother would call you to get up for school and how you would lie about when you were getting up. Like, and you're still laying in bed. I don't remember it verbatim now, but that hit me when I was a kid, that there was somebody who literally took every morning of my life at that point. And it was an adult doing it in like front of another adult. It was incredible. And I got to watch that, but then I still don't think, like, I knew what stand-up was, and I kind of knew like in that way, but it wasn't until I was watching reruns of Mork and Mindy when I was a kid, and Robin Williams was like, you know, just the guy. It was crazy because I think I saw Fern Gully before I saw any Mork and Mindy stuff, and then made the connection that, oh, the guy who does the voice of the bat is the same voice of this alien guy. And then when I would start to like look into who they were, and it was like, oh, he started out in comedy. And then I was like, really? Like doing stand up. And then it was him. Everybody had a show, Paul Reiser, Seinfeld, Ellen DeGeneres, everybody that was on TV started out doing stand up comedy. And that's when I was like, well, what is, you know, what, all these guys got a TV show and they started just talking to people, talking to strangers. And I was like, I talk to strangers all the time. Like, I like talking to strangers. And I like being funny, and that was it. That's what piqued my interest into stand-up.
So you wanted your own television sitcom, what you're saying?
I did, yeah. I knew I wanted to be a comedian, and I thought the acting thing was, like, part of it. I mean, it was back then. For comedians back then, it was like you did 5 minutes on Carson, and they handed you a show. think about, like, those guys shaped comedy in a huge comedians actually, like, I think if people don't really realize it, but like comedians shaped the way writers thought, the way the culture spoke and thought about things, because from the 60s, you know, 60s, 70s and 80s, you had these, you know, generations of comedians. And it wasn't until like late 70s, early 80s when it started to be like they would all write their own material. And they started to really break down their lives, their childhood, their traumas, whatever it was. But people would go to see live entertainment before they would go really watch too much stuff on TV. And that kind of shaped, you know, TV comedy and then certain movies and stuff. Animal House was all Second City people and, you know, and certain comics, stuff like that. SNL had, you know, Carlin, Steve Martin were hosts, you know, all those guys, like, It was just ingrained in the culture. So I feel like a lot of people don't even realize how much of what they find funny comes from comedians and people performing at the Improv and the Comedy Store back in the day.
Yeah, I think you're right about like the live comedy thing was a lot more of a big deal. Like, you know, I'm certainly old enough where the internet as a means of getting comedy out there wasn't there until I was,
right,
you know, an adult. So a lot of people I would just hear about, not even literally see them, but somebody would yeah. tell the joke. Like, for instance, remember when Jim Gaffigan did the Hot Pocket thing? I heard mm-hmm. the Hot Pocket joke from hundreds of people before I ever once saw Jim Gaffigan do it. And I don't yeah. think I ever saw, I just saw him on TV eventually, but I did not, right. like, I heard that joke from everybody, right?
Yeah.
Also, I'm from Boston, so I remember when Dane Cook started doing stuff and, like, started right. getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And, like, you'd hear about this guy, oh, there's this show over here, and you're like, what? You know, like, millions yeah. of people are going to it. What? You know, so yeah. I don't know. The live scene was definitely a big deal. I mean, certainly from my point of view, living in Boston in, like, high school and stuff, like, hearing about different yeah. things and finding out through people, as opposed to it all just being on the internet and I can Google, like, funny guy.
Yeah, Boston was an incredible comedy scene. I mean, it's still yeah. like Boston, New York, and Los Angeles, you know, like, or San Francisco too, but, like, those places were just delivered the best people. Like, they really did. They cranked out all these amazing comics. And the thing is, too, is, like, again, about it being almost ingrained in the culture, because I forgot about this too, is, like, there were, when you look back at those shows and who wrote for them, they were comedians. You know what I mean? Like, they were guys that maybe necessarily didn't have the, you know, stage presence or the want, basically, to keep going out on the road like some of the other guys did. But they were the ones who still developed an act and cultivated their sense of humor, you know, cutting their teeth at these comedy clubs. And then they got deals to write for shows. You know, they became writers. So they all wrote, you know, Gary Shandling wrote for TV long before he wrote for his own shows or whatever. And he was a comic. And he wrote for Sanford and Son and a couple other things. So, like, all these people came from that scene in the club and then just developed, you know, they became ingrained in the, like, the TV, you know, every show, every TV show, every sketch show, HBO, that kind of stuff. It's crazy to me when you think about how many people like that came out of comedy.
I mean, it's such an important part, especially now. Having taught in improv for a long time, it's especially important with, like, you know, acting for, like, commercials and stuff. Like, they're always concerned right. about improv. And what they want for improv is different than what improv actually is. But but at the same time, like, the vibe of comedy in things like commercials is there. And, you know, it's pervasive, you know, like you'll remember a time of, like, a certain year based on, like, a commercial that you saw. And that's because it was funny or people talked yeah. about it, you know. But yeah, you're right. The comedians and the things that they are developing are, you know, as close as we can get to having a finger on the pulse of what's going on. And that's, you know, say what you will about how now there's too much comedy going on all the time, but I like the fact that we're even closer to the pulse. Like, you know,
yeah.
with comedy, they go on the road, they can talk about what's happening in the world. Whereas, like, you know, you watch a movie or a television show, that was written months ago. And
right.
you know, maybe it's relevant, but that's only lucky. Or it's relevant yeah. in a larger cultural sense, you know, but not in a way where, like I love it when SNL makes a joke about something that happened, like, that week, right? And
yeah.
you'll be like,
yeah.
yes, you know, that, like, you know, feeling that moment of everyone being like, I remember when that thing happened and I like that we're making fun of it. Yes. Like,
yep.
you know, it yeah. brings us together.
It left it, like, that's why when I feel like when Jon Stewart left The Daily Show, I mean, there's still shows like that around. But, like, that was very much his, you know, his baby. And everything was kind of filtered through him. So it's hard to replicate that kind of thing if you don't have any, like sincerity for it. But like when that was on TV, you know, that was the same thing. It was like whatever was happening that day, it could have been in the last couple hours, those guys would still be writing about, you know, anything that was happening in the news. So you'd hear it immediately. And it was a great kind of cathartic feeling to be like, oh, yes, I just saw the news 2 hours ago. That's exactly what happened.
You know what's interesting, though, to the credit of the building of that show, the choices that they made for actors and performers and writers to be part of that show, they really did their homework as far as people who were already working on that kind of material. Because, like, not everybody's doing current event stuff. Not everybody cares about politics. And they just did a good job to find a bunch of people who not only had the skills to do the comedy, but like to actually do the work of writing these true, like, good pieces. You can't do satire unless you fully understand the subject at hand, right? So they were just very intelligent, and they just did a good job of putting people together to do that. I mean, that being said, a lot of people talk about, you know, Jon Stewart, it couldn't have happened without him. It's because that show was singular, and it hadn't happened before. And now anything that might happen is, like many things, just sort of like a trying to figure out how to capture that magic again. And that is not to say that Trevor Noah isn't wonderful when he presents the Daily Show in his own way. I actually love what he does, but his vibe is different. And and also the way that we consume news because of the Jon Stewart Daily Show is different. Right. So now he has to approach it differently because changed.
Yeah, and the closest to that show is I felt this since he came on after Fallon is Seth Meyers. Seth Meyers is the closest version with the same kind of wit and passion and opinion mixed in with, like, his ideology is filtered through his comedy, that kind of a thing. Trevor did a good job.
Seth Meyers has been literally writing and curating our comedy for the past, like, 20 years.
Yeah,
like, he's been, like, head writer at SNL for longer than you knew. And all of it, like, wait, when did he start wearing that? Like, he literally was the person who told us what to laugh at for years and years and years. So the fact that his show, where he's the focus and he's talking about current events, is relatable makes total sense. Like, we love him.
It makes absolute sense. He's just got that same kind of, you know, mindset for it, which is great, which I feel like the other guys, you know, have a hard time finding.
So is that the kind of show that got you into it? Like, was it stand-up that was exciting to you when you were thinking about developing your own creative stuff? Or did you watch some of these other sort of ensemble shows and think, yeah, that's what I want to do? Did you get involved with any of that kind of stuff?
Well, like, my first two, like I said, the Richard Jenny and stuff I thought was hilarious. I like pure, you know, comedy and stuff, but I found myself leaning towards, like, when I was in high school, towards the guys that had something to say, because I also had something to say. Like, I felt like there were just a lot of injustices in general that I picked up on. And I feel like my family's a little, like, my mom was like that, you know, so I picked up on that from her a little bit when I was growing up. And my uncle too. So, like, that just made sense. Like, even when I was in school, like, aside from just being funny, I remember, like, I was, like, in elementary school, and I think the principal at the time was a real piece of work. Look at me being clean. But she, there was something to do with our recess time. Like, our lunch times and recess were, like, the same, basically. So it was whenever you finish your lunch, you got to go out and play. But some people finished their lunch faster because you had to wait online. If you brought your own lunch, you would get out to play faster because you got to eat your stuff and go. But if you had to wait on that line, it was depending on how fast the lunch lady left, went, right? So it was unfair. So I would, I think I got a bunch of kids to walk down to the main office to be like, wait, let me tell you what for, and wait, this is ridiculous. And, you know, we did like a thing or whatever. So there was a lot of stuff that, like, I don't know, when I wound up getting older and, like, I saw these comedians kind of talking about the same stuff. Like, Bill Maher was a, then when I was in high school, I saw Be More Cynical came out my freshman year, and that was a stand-up special. And it kind of changed my perspective a little bit because I had heard Carlin, but Carlin was an older dude, you know, and he was funny and, you know, very insightful about some stuff. But then came, you know, Bill and Politically Incorrect in his special, and he was kind of hitting marks. There was like an adult actually saying the things I was thinking about, you know, being overworked and as a freshman in high school, but you know what I mean? Like all that drugs, being overworked, you know, the police, the political culture, you know, religion, all that stuff. And there was an adult saying it on stage and in a funny way and super clever. So I remember always being that guy in class who would like say the other, like, well, what about this? And trying to twist something in a way that would kind of suit my personality.
So did you do a lot of political comedy at the like high school talent shows?
No, I never did. I was kind of clever about me being funny. I wanted to let other people. So here's the thing. I was not, I was funny when I was in class. My whole thing was like there were two class clowns. And I remember these kids. They were brothers and they were literally the pull your pants down, zany faces. Those guys. They would do that kind of stuff. And I feel like in the same respect, I appreciated it, but that just wasn't me. And I was the back of the classroom, wise ass, try to get the teacher to laugh so that we'd waste time, you know, that kind of a thing. And that was always the goal. If I could get adults to break and laugh around me or by saying something clever or having something witty to say, you know, even to the extent of like learning the material in class was only because I wanted to be able to be smart enough to make a joke about it. I was like, oh, if I don't know what we're talking about, I can't be funny. I didn't give a shit about doing the homework. I was just like, oh, I need to know the material because how can I play? You know, so there was that kind of a thing. But I never did stand up. I wish I had. I think that would have been cool. I think people said I liked the idea of my friends and people who kind of knew me saying I should do it and then not doing it. Because it was so safe to me in high school. And my whole thing was like, so when I was in sixth grade, and I found this a couple of years ago, we had like yearbooks, you know, because I went to elementary school and it was whatever to sixth grade. And then you went to high school, right? Or middle school, seventh to eighth, and then high school. So we did the sixth grade yearbook and it was like, what do you want to, you know, what do you want to be? And I put two things down. It was only comedian or cartoonist because I love to draw and I can. And apparently I had no intention of making any money. So I was like, those two, that's it. you know, hit or miss, that's all I'm going to be. And then, so when I was in high school, I still did drawings for like the school newspaper and stuff. And I felt it was very safe to say I'm a cartoonist and that's what I want to do. But I loved it because it let me be funny without the pressure of anybody. Because the minute you say you're funny, people are like, that guy's not funny. It gives people the okay to judge you for it. And I wasn't ready to be judged yet.
Or to like call guys, you on it. Oh yeah, funny guy, yeah. Be funny.
You're like, exactly.
You're like, what?
Exactly.
You know, hey, welder, weld. I can't, that's not how that works.
Yeah. But I loved, another thing I liked too is I just got the reputation around my high school. People knew who I was before I knew them because I was just the guy that was funny. So like, and I did get a little bit of that where like some dude who, you know, super insecure or whatever would be like, oh, why is it this kid? Like this kid's fun. You know what I mean? And like, but I love not being funny around them either because it just drove them even more. You know what I mean? Like if I tried to do it and failed, that would just prove them right. So I would never, I'd be like, yeah, no, I'm funny, but you'll see it when you see it. Like, you know, it was just this great power I had at the time. And I liked keeping it on the DL.
Yeah. So did you go to college?
I did for a year, and that's when I dropped out to do stand up. I went to, I went to, so basically I was close friends with, a real, and she just passed away about a year ago. And, but
Sorry.
she and I were very close. We knew each other since we were 12, and she was, there was like a couple kids in my high school who were theater kids, and I did a play once, and then was kind of slightly involved with theater, but never performed again. But there were kids who were super talented, and this one of my closest friends played five, six different instruments. She was like, you know, just a genius at that kind of stuff. Wrote music, knew exactly what she wanted to do from day one. And her dad, you know, her dad was a musician too, so they had that bond. And she knew I was funny, and she was always very supportive. And then senior year of high school, she was like, "Why are you going college?" And I didn't know what, I didn't have an answer. I had like no clue. And I was like, "Well, obviously, because everybody else is going, and that's the thing I should do." And you know, and the girl I was dating at the time was also going to college, so it just felt like a thing to do. She's like, "You should move to LA with me, and I'm going to do this, this, and this." And I was like, "Kudos, but I can't do any of that." And then I went to college for a year, hated every minute of it, didn't know what I wanted to do, was full aware of, like, I didn't get a scholarship to go anywhere, you know what I mean? Or like a free ride, like some of my friends did. And I was in like honors classes and stuff, but I just, you know, I didn't know what I wanted to do, so I kind of floundered there. And then I was taking a bunch of weird classes because took a poli sci class, took a psych class, took a creative writing class, and then I was like, I'm wasting money, and I really wanted to perform. And then a bunch of stuff happened. My girlfriend cheated on me. That sent me down a bit of a depression kind of thing. And then also not knowing what I wanted to do in college. And then I came across this class that you could take in New York City. Like it was a pamphlet or something like that. It was like how to be a comedian. And then I just said to my parents, like, "This is what I want to do. And I, you know, do you mind if I drop out and try it?" And they were like, "Do
Man, mental
it."
note, pamphlet up some colleges with a random class, how to be a comedian. I don't know why I'm
Right?
not doing this.
I don't know
Jeez.
where that came from. I don't even know if my mother saw it. But it was one of those things that was a very weird, like what you would hear, like from kids in the 60s, where they'd like find a be an artist in the back of a comic book,
Yeah.
and they'd send, you know, or whatever. But like it was like that, and the thing that felt safer than quitting school to do open mics randomly, you know, which I kind of was vaguely aware of. But like this was just another form of school. So it was still a safety net to be like, yeah, I'm leaving one school, but I'm going to another one. But in the meantime, that school was only like, I don't know, 6 weeks, 6, 7 weeks long.
Okay,
And,
I have
you know,
so many questions about this,
shoot. Yeah.
like
Sorry. I was talking
space. No, you're perfect. No, I will talk over you because that's what I do. But what I mean is, I have so many questions about this school. Tell me about the class. What was it, an old man or an old woman that ran it? Was the
Not
building empty all the time? Were there
an
ghosts? And how many photos on the wall were actual famous people? Okay.
Okay, so that's, I know exactly what kind of rooms you're talking about. I've taken my clothes off in many of them. I'm just kidding.
Ay,
like, what is this? Are we doing it? No, this was on, oh man, I want to say it was on 38th Street in Manhattan. It was so great because I loved going into the city anyway, and I did it like as soon as I could drive in high school. My friends and I would go.
38th Street. Good
38th and
Lord. 38th and
38th and
what? By Times Square, you were bamboozled.
close. Yeah, no. This was, I'm telling you, this was so, there were other comedy classes that people took.
Sure.
I got lucky because,
Well.
this was like most of them are scams, and most of them are basically like, I'm running out of options and I need to pay rent. I'm going to start a comedy class. So
Right.
the guy who like ran Caroline's at the time, or was second in command there, his name is Andy Engel. That guy's a real like shuckster. Like he was selling, you know, whatever. But the woman who taught my class, her name is Linda Smith, and she was on a bunch of Showtime specials when she was you know, younger, because she was out of Boston, and she was a ball busting Boston comic who worked the road. And then after she did those specials with, like, you know, Judy Gold, Carol Leifer, like, she came up with those guys. She wrote for the Rosie O'Donnell Show. She's the head writer. So she won Emmys, and she was very familiar with joke writing and material coming up with that day. And, you know, she knew all the other comics who were like, she opened for, like, a bunch of famous people on the road and stuff when she was younger. So she knew her stuff. And immediately when I went to, like, to talk to her and have that class, we clicked. So when I walked into the classroom, it was 30 of us. And it was like, this is, I don't know what this is, but it seemed fun. And it was a mic stand in the middle, and the other side, because it was a studio, so I think they did dance stuff in there too, but there was a giant mirrored wall on one side, mm-hmm. and then just folding chairs, and then a desk, maybe it was a piano, I don't even know, where Linda had her stuff and her materials and her ditto sheets or whatever. But it was so much, so you had to, I didn't know this because they didn't tell me, most likely I didn't read it. But you had to come up with, first day of class, with 2 minutes of material to perform in front of the class. That's what you had to bring. And I had nothing. But I'd been writing down jokes that I had written since, like, high school. I had notebooks filled. So I already come with a notebook. And I had already had stuff that I would, you know, say to friends that I would slip in as material or whatever. Like, I'd just always been like that. So I went up and did 2 minutes. And, like, in front of these 30 strangers who also wanted to be funny and did really well. And she was like, that was good. Like, what? And I was like, well, because you know what I did? I said, I don't have anything. And I didn't know we were supposed to do this. She goes, great, just get in front of the class and do something anyway. Like, what? So I had, like, you know, some stuff. And she was like, that was great. You had nothing and you came up with something that's really good. And then she nicknamed me Miles. Because I had like round glasses at the time, and I reminded her of one of the characters, Murphy Brown. We had an instant connection, mm-hmm. and I am now. There's only me and one other person in that entire class who still do stand up.
Wow.
But yeah, we did. I just did. It was. I knew that's where I wanted to be. It was the only time I enjoyed going someplace where there was an instructor. She held our attention. You know. And she got me right away because I did I like to improvise when I'm on stage. And we were just talking about how there's two different forms of what improv, you know, what improv artists do, and then what when you improvise on a stage or like for commercials or whatever. But like I like to keep my stuff loose and whatever. And she knew it right away. She knew it from the way I wrote jokes to how I perform naturally because I wouldn't perform the same way every time. And my first time on stage at Caroline's for that show, you know, you're supposed to invite people that you knew, but I only invited like 10. And to their credit, my parents came and a couple of my friends came to see me. And then the rest of the audience were all strangers. And I had a phenomenal time and a great set to the point where like I blew through my own material and I still had a couple minutes left. And Linda knew enough to know that I'd be fast. Like she was able to talk to me. Like she said something like off the cuff on stage to me on stage. And I responded in a way that was funny, whatever, got this huge laugh. So it's one of those things that's very weird because a couple of my friends and I who are still doing it, we'll talk about like your first time goes that well on stage. You are almost always chasing the purity of that high, even though you're not that good, but it's such a pure instant moment in time that you're like, oh, that was the best. You know, may not have had the best material, but you were just so full of energy and, you know, dumb hope that it was like a really nice moment. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I'm sure that's the case. You know, people are just sort of chasing that initial high.
Yeah. Yeah. And you have moments. I mean, I've had great, great times on stage, a lot of fun, but I like it's that first time was so. Like ingrained in my head, because I guess that's when it's like falling in love for the first time, because yeah. That was the first time I've been on stage and the first time I realized, oh, I'm never not going to do this, and that was it. And as bad as it got when I was, you know, hit or miss every night and working on new stuff and bombing, constantly, and you know, those long rides back home, I was still like, no, this is it. This is what I'm going to be doing.
What kept you into it?
I think it was just, I really loved when it was good. And then you learn to love when it's bad, by the way, because you know you're good. So it's a weird mix, but like, I loved doing it when it was good. When you have a thought and an idea and you immediately know it's funny, and then you can get you can get a bunch of strangers to also see that it's funny. It's the most pure connection I think you can make. It's, here's some words I thought of. I put them in an order that sounds appealing, and it sparks something in your brain that also makes you go, I've either never seen it that way, or I've done exactly that, and now I feel like I know this guy. And then that's it. And you don't have to say anything else. You know, I think Doug Stanhope talked about comedy or whatever, and like he said something that always sat with me because I felt the same way, and you know, didn't know how to quite put it, but you know, comedy isn't just done on stage too. It's like literally making the cashier or the stranger in line laugh, you know, at a grocery store or whatever. And that's stuff I used to do before I even started performing. It was like, well, what can I say in this moment in time right now that everyone is feeling, but in a way that gets a laugh? And, you know, that's, I think, what keeps me going, because to be able to create something, you know, and then, you know, share it with people. Oh, great.
That's what's been keeping me going in, you know, COVID times, right? Like I was mentioning earlier, going to, you know, Walgreens and putting a weird hat on and winking at people. Like, yes. I just want to, like, especially now, like, but I try to do it. Well, pre-COVID, I used to like just chat with strangers whenever I thought somebody needed somebody to connect to. And I'll talk about anything. I don't care.
Yep.
It doesn't have to be like, it'll just be like deodorant. Am I right? Like, it doesn't matter what it is.
Right.
If I think they need to be distracted or whatever, or they look sad. Like, I've done crazy things, like knock stuff over. And then like, oh my God, I'm such a klutz, just to distract people.
And you know what's funny too, is sometimes it can be kind of selfish too, because sometimes it's not always about, hey, does that person need to be distracted? Sometimes I'm bored and I want to see where the situation's going to go. Everybody else enjoys it, great. But you know, sometimes I need it for me too.
Well, yeah, my talking to strangers now is fully grasping for some human connection that's not my internal family. Like, I'm just all like, things are crazy, right, cashier? What do you think, other person that lie in the line? Right? But it's just me trying to maintain my former semblance of a wacky self, right?
Yeah.
So you mentioned that you really enjoy the connection that you make with the audience. And we're talking now about, you know, making connections with people. Is that what keeps you going for developing material? You clearly at this point, maybe not right at this moment, but you've traveled and toured. And, you know, I went to your website. There's a lot of interviews with you in various towns on morning shows. Like, you're a mover and a shaker and talking to people. Like, how did that journey feel for you as a person who likes to connect with people?
That felt amazing. That's another thing I think I miss almost that as much as I miss performing. I miss packing a bag and driving, you know, 10 hour or whatever it is to another state, and you know, sleeping in a hotel and meeting people and stuff like that. Like, I love walking down the hallway of a hotel and seeing who's down the hallway. I love seeing people in the lobby, the person who works the night shift. I know I'm going to be seeing them for most of the weekend. You know, the local shops in town or whatever. Like, I love that, all of that. So that's a huge part of it for me. And that's a lot of fun for me. I love traveling. And the longer the road trip, the better, because I don't mind being in the car. As long as there's no traffic, the windows open, music playing, you know, I'm ready to go.
So did Linda Smith help you make the connections you needed to get going and start traveling and touring? Like, after this class, how did you figure it out?
Well, she, no, I shouldn't say no. I'm just, but like, I, you know what's crazy? I think actually, I shouldn't, yeah, she did help a lot. Because
she's probably not going to listen, so it's okay. I mean,
she's stabbing me. No, I'm just kidding. She was actually super, super great. I was thinking of it in terms of like, I bet you I had a better time getting work out of that than most of my friends got out of getting work out of college. Like, you know, for spending 60 grand to go to a college a year or whatever, and then coming out with no job at the end of it. Because that was the point where, like, you know, high school graduated 2004. So then in 2008, we were still, you know, in a recession, so to speak. So all my friends graduated college, and most of them either lost their jobs immediately when they got out of it, and then were working retail again, or whatever they were doing, or living back with their parents. And I was in my own apartment and touring the colleges that they went to, you know, doing stand-up. So it was kind of a flip. But Linda helped. She liked me a lot. And then, you know, she helped me get, like, other gigs in the city. But the reason I got to go on the road was because through those gigs, I met a couple other people, like other comics. So, like, I did gigs in New Jersey, and she always left it so I could call her, which I don't know if she did for another student. She may have. But, like, for me, I could have called Linda and been like, hey, I need some advice. Because I got stuff pretty early. Like, I had I'd taken a clip of my stand-up, which this is, again, people, I think we talked about it briefly before we even started recording, but basically people who didn't know any better, you know, when you have that false bravado where you're just like, oh, I don't know any better, I'm good. And I took a clip of my stand-up and submitted it to Sony, had a website called Crackle in the beginning. And you can take a minute of your comedy or whatever video you had and post it on their site. And my video made it to the top front page. And I was only a year in. And I won some kind of Sony something something award. And then I got entered into this thing, and I needed a headshot. And I needed a resume. I had neither. So I called Linda, and she was like, don't sign anything. Because they also sent me a contract, which basically I think just said that, they're allowed to do whatever they want with the material I sent them. And she was like, you know, she walked me through that and, you know, just said, go get a headshot. And I went and got glamour shots in the mall.
Yes.
Good stuff.
Man.
And me and 80 children. And they were like, are you the father of one of these? I was like, God, no. I'm here to get my own photo.
No. Best. Best.
Yeah. And so I was able to call her for stuff. And then I started calling, like, every club that I would just Google. I worked at a bank at the time, full time. So I would go to work, sit at my desk and not work, and then Google comedy clubs. And then go like, okay, well, I'm going to call this place and this place. I would do it from my desk at the bank. And then people would be like, oh, can I get a money market account? I'm like, you can hold on like 2 seconds. Just trying to secure my future here. while you desperately need to cash a check.
You're like, listen, I will be with you in just one moment. So 10 p.m.
Yeah.
Shakey's? Yeah, okay, I got it.
Yes, exactly. First timers? Okay. And the funny thing is that bank was in the side of a grocery store, because the year that I started working for the bank, or for PNC, was the year they decided we're going to have banks inside grocery stores. And we were a sales branch, so we actually had to get accounts. So it was like, have you guys taken out a loan for a home yet? Do you want paper or plastic? What do you need? it was like the weirdest. But I performed at a comedy club called The Rascals. And it was around since like the 80s in, oh my God, Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And then I met a guy there named Vinny, who had started a few years before me. Good guy. I'm still close with him. He's like to my writing partner. When we work on stuff to pitch. Now we have an Amazon Prime short film, plug for me. on Amazon Prime right now. But
What's
he knew another guy. It's called Dup It.
What?
It's called a Duppet, Duppet, like a Muppet, but with a D, and
Oh, okay.
So it's Duppet. So he introduced me to another guy in the city who ran a show at the Improv, in New York, which is now Broadway Comedy Club. And then I met him, and he was like, "I have a DUI. Do you want to go out on the road?" I was like, "Yes, I do." And I kind of cut my teeth on the road with him. And we wound up becoming friends. So I bypassed most of the like bringer stuff that you had to do in New York. Because at first, to get stage time, you had to bring like, you know, your entire family and dig up relatives when they were tired of going to see you. And but this guy was like, "No, you don't need to do any of that." And I did it for a little bit, like, but he picked me up pretty quickly. And, you know, I got paid work real quick.
So did you just called and asked?
I did. And I think that took most people by surprise too, because it was, you know, it was kind of unusual. I mean, I'm sure other people kind of did too, but I
no
was
way,
very
it's totally
like...
unusual. Nobody asks for what they actually want.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah, I did. I called, I mean, every comedy club I could go to that I thought would take me. And I think they just kind of admired, you know, that anybody, because they didn't have to really pay me. You know, it was like, "Oh, can I just talk?" Because I was auditioning. So I didn't have to bring anybody, but I got guest spots on main shows. So the audience was packed. And that's also how I wound up meeting other, like, comics, but other headliners and stuff, too. And that's also how I wound up getting good, because instead of doing the same 5 minutes of material, which I think is what most people did, I was like, "No, I'm still writing." And I had like 3 jokes, but I wanted to, you know, I knew I had a sense for playing with the crowd and improvising on stage. So I was like, "Well, if I'm going to get really good at that, which is what I want to be, I'm going to need to go up with a couple jokes that I know work and then see what happens." So I would do that.
Ooh, sounds risky.
And again, this is, it was. Now looking back on it, it totally was, because there were club owners who were like, "Yeah, you haven't earned the right to," even when it went well, they were still like, "You haven't earned the right to do that kind of stuff yet." Like, they didn't care if you were funny. They cared if you were going to, you know, screw over the guy who was not able to do that. But I would just say yes and then still do whatever I wanted.
Whatever. In the comedy world, there's such a like, you got to earn your place, man. You got to put in your time, man. It's like, no, you don't. I'm super sorry. Am I upset that there is a 16-year-old who goes on like whatever the new app is and becomes 3 times as famous as I'll ever be? Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I'm a little annoyed.
Yeah.
But am I going to like stop them from doing it because like I paid my dues? No. Come on. Come on.
Exactly. And that's a lot of it too. I feel like getting over that kind of, you know, insecurity and you know, hump is like important, because that's how guys I knew on the road were bitter. I remember one time this headliner reamed me out because I didn't have a watch on. And he was like, "How are you going to tell me when I'm supposed to get off stage?" And I literally was like, "You've been doing this for 35 years. You don't know when your act ends." And we had this huge blowout. And I had never met him before or whatever. And I was like working these. And we were, by the way, we were in a really garbage room anyway. But this is a guy who was looking to yell at somebody.
Yeah.
And didn't like that I was young and probably had hair.
Yeah, I mean, what's really weird is, you know, we were talking earlier about the idea of like what is funny and like how it changes generationally. Like, even like when we were talking about like SNL and like The Daily Show, like at certain times of the world, certain things are funny and we deal with them in different ways. And like, even like now in COVID, like, I feel like the way that we as a world are taking in comedy and television shows is different than we did before, right? It's a little bit more immediate that you know if people like or dislike something in a way that's different. But in that same way, we're artists, right? So we have to ebb and flow with the way that the audience is receiving the information. We can't just be like, "I'm the gatekeeper of funny words, and if you don't like me, too bad." Like,
yeah. And that's funny too, because that is like the way, you know, I very rarely ever make references to something that, like on TV or whatever, because, you know, unless it's something huge, unless it's like Game of Thrones, that, you know, at least there's a huge percentage that watches it. I don't know if anybody else is watching Ozark. So I don't, I'm not, that doesn't hit my radar that way. I'm not going to be material about it.
Sure.
You know, I don't know if any, you know, and there's nobody, you know, nobody sees commercials anymore. Like, everybody fast forwards them. So there's no way I'm like mining television, you know, for referential bits.
Yeah. Plus, you know, even the top 10 Netflix tells you people are watching. That's some BS.
Yes, exactly.
That's not real. That's just my algorithm.
Yep.
I was like, no right. way. No way is America watching this. No.
Yeah. And also, like, there's a certain kind of, and I've noticed this, you know, over the last few years, there's a general homogeny to stuff online. And even, I feel like even comedians now are falling prey to it, where, like, you know, you see a structure to how social media works. So everybody just, like, they see one thing go viral. And they're like, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that thing. And the same thing, it's like, TikTok's a great example. How many people do the same dance? And they're like, and there's no one does it particularly better than the other person. But it's who sees it and who has the following and who shares it. And it's a race. And I feel like it kind of ruins creativity a little bit. Because you're just, at that point, you're like, oh, I need exposure. So I'm going to try to do exactly whatever this is. And then people get angry because they're like, well, I did it. Why is that guy going famous? Why is that guy going viral and I'm not?
You know what, though? Like, I actually think of it the way I think of dating. Like, you're going out there. You're trying to mingle and figure out what people are interested in, right? You're trying to put your art out there. You like this? You like this? You like this? And then you see what they like. And yeah, people will very often like lean into whatever that is. But that's very rarely what it is you need to be doing. You need to be doing yourself. And then it will work itself out in the way that it needs to. Like, especially right now, your audience will find you, you know? My husband says all the time that you need one or the other to be successful, time or money, right? If you have money, sure. You can get all those followers. If you're already famous, great. There you go. You got them all. They're listening to your podcast, even if it's super dumb and has low quality audio, you know, like, doesn't matter. They're going to be part of it because they've already ticked into you. But like, the idea of like chasing the viral video and like trying to figure out what people are going to be into, I just feel like they're using the wrong algorithm. They're like looking at it as if they can manufacture what people are going to care about, as opposed to like paying attention to like cultural shifts and like trying to, in my mind, it's always a storytelling thing. Like, this happened. So what in the story, what do they need? Right. So like, for instance, I don't mean to bring up terrible tragedies, but this is a storytelling reference, I promise. After 9/11 happened, there were a ton of movies about superheroes. That's when all that stuff started, because we culturally needed to feel saved. We felt vulnerable as a group, right? And we needed something to make us feel better, right? So then we got those movies. Because that's what the storytelling brains of the people that were out there decided to put out that we needed, right? But that's a longer game, right, than comedy is. Like we were talking about, you used to have years to decide what you're going to put in a movie, and it like could come out 3 years later. But when you're a comedian, you need to be in the middle of the pulse and figure it out. It's like every day I go to Twitter and I look to see what's trending, not because I actually care, but because I'm just fascinated at what people are talking about.
Yeah, same. And it is kind of an addiction thing too. And to see what you need to, like, you know, I'll do it because, you know, I'll be on Sirius Radio, like, you know, 4 or 5 times a month or whatever. And it's a political show or it's a, you know, topical. So like, I know I need to do it, but like, I posted a TikTok video And I wasn't a big TikTok person. I still don't particularly like it. I get it. But I did. And I was like, because it's, we're all trying different stuff during the pandemic. And but I did. I posted this video of me doing stand up like in February before COVID hit. And there were some Trump supporters in the audience, and they were heckling or whatever, and kind of cut it down. And it was funny. And then posted it, and it's almost at 1 million views. And I went from like 12 followers on TikTok to like over 6,000 in a couple days. But it's very funny because, as much of a thing that is, I realized the other videos that did well were when I was doing the Trump stuff or critical politically or commenting on something like that. And they didn't care so much for me. So there's still that struggle where it's not that they didn't care for me, but it was like, oh, this is the content I came here for. And it's crazy how niche it is, because it doesn't matter if you've got like 20,000 followers or whatever it is. It's like, where'd they come from, and what did they come to see? Because they're not on board for the whole package. They're on board for this very specific thing that you do, or
Right.
they think you do.
And then
And
you have to make that decision. Am I going to do what they want me to do, or am I going to do me and wait it out for my, Prince Charming, just to
yeah, and much
continue
to
that
my
metaphor.
manager's chagrin is always, I'll never do, like, if, see, here's the thing, if the mood strikes me and I see something funny politically or whatever, and I feel like it's got some weight to it, that's when I post, and I do something to it if I have a strong opinion about something. But I cannot do that thing that, and I give people credit who can do it. I guess it's like an A type A personality or whatever it is. Well, they'll go every day at this time, I have to produce a video, and they do it, and it kind of gets them what they need. I can't work like that. And I think the bad side of that is people who beat themselves up over the fact that that's not them, because they're like, all these people are, I'm not moving fast enough on social media, to gain the followers I need to be somebody. And it's like, yeah, but are you that person anyway? So,
So
it's like,
what's your creative process then? Like, what are you trying to create, much to the chagrin of your manager?
no, he's fine with it. I at the moment I'm working on a couple different projects. I mean, I've got a podcast that I've been working on for a while, but it's not really a podcast. It's called Dystopia Tonight, and it's a streaming. I mean, it'll be on podcast services or whatever, but for the most part, it's visually streaming. And it was an idea that I had set up to be ready to pitch to some networks. And then when COVID hit, I was like, well, we can water this down for still a great name. And, I had an Instagram account set up for it and stuff. And I was like, so we'll cut some stuff and we'll do it just from my, house and play around with it or whatever. And it took a few months for me to work on writing some stuff for it and doing some stuff. And it's actually going to get, first episode is going to be next week. So
Great.
that we're actually shooting it. Yeah. So like I'm working on stuff like that. I still like post memes and write jokes, and I still work on my material and still writing all the time, and I'm doing commission work for illustration stuff or whatever. And so there's still comedy stuff that I still, do. I put together a Christmas special thing that I'm doing on the 12th this Saturday, that's going to Toys for Tots. So it's me and a bunch of other comedians. I'm always doing podcasts. I'm always on something or being interviewed or doing press to keep myself going and sharp and stuff. Like I said, I'm on Sirius all the time. But like I use Instagram more than anything else. My Twitter is basically a ghost town. I was shadow banned not too long ago for doing some Trump stuff that went viral. Like I've had a few things go viral, but it's very like, it's when I feel like it. Sometimes I have something that's really good and I want to post it, and sometimes it's pure garbage. I just don't. I'm not a post every day kind of person. I can't do it.
It's tough.
Yeah, it is tough. And I wrote for and I wrote an article for Newsweek, my first article for Newsweek a few weeks ago. So that was exciting. Like I have like there's I love doing stand up and I love being funny and I love doing all that stuff, but I have other interests like creatively too. So I try to feed the bear, so to speak. as much as possible to for all that other stuff too.
So are your other entertainment interests in writing?
Yeah. I wrote for years for other comedians and other shows and stuff. And I like doing that kind of thing. I don't really like particularly like writing for other comedians so much. I like writing for myself better, but I learned how to do it. So that was a nice, skill for the resume.
It is a good skill.
Yeah. And also, like, that's another good point about this pandemic, too. It's like, I feel like everybody's gotten the opportunity to exercise, you know, skills that they might not necessarily have. Like, the podcasting thing is new for me. Going on them, I was always doing it. But, like, actually, like, having equipment and grabbing stuff for myself and figuring out all that stuff is new.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lifeline for sure. Connects me to people across the world.
Yeah, exactly. And for people who like to talk, why wouldn't you? Like, I've had people ask me a million times why I didn't, haven't had one before, and it was always like, I feel like other people do it really well. Like, there's plenty of people who do them really, really well. So, you
know, plus, I mean, you know, you can be like, oh, I don't host podcasts. I'm a guest. I'm a guest.
Yeah, podcast. And I love being a guest.
I'm available. But
yeah,
that's just my role.
Right.
I'm so sorry.
But this thing with Dystopia is a little different. So it like piqued my interest to like do something that's not, you know, like just pure talking to somebody.
Yeah, man. So you know, explore, do other things, be an exciting and new, right? Why not?
Exactly. I've got an OnlyFans account now. It's just me eating sandwiches right now, but that's
great. Can you get people to eat sandwiches?
Oh, no, I can't. Really no, that'd be, I would, if I had one, that's what I would be. I think that'd be hilarious.
I just really want Keegan Michael Key eating a sandwich. Like, I just want to see it. I just want there to be a video that I own.
Wow.
That's just him eating a sandwich. I know that's probably
that's
not
pretty
even
great,
but I want to watch it. I don't know why.
Yeah. Keegan-Michael Key is very specific, so I feel like you know what you want. That makes me very confident in you.
Well, you know, he's a great comedian. Everything that he's in is super great, and, like, mm-hmm. I just can't get enough of him. And right. I was so excited about a show that he was in. I literally was like, I love that guy so much, I want to watch him eat a sandwich. And then I was like, oh, I probably could get him to eat a sandwich if I paid for
That's
it.
That's hilarious.
You know, he'd do it, I bet. We'll see.
Yeah, I bet he would.
Yeah, we'll see. If anyone listening knows Keegan Michael Key and can get me a video of him eating a sandwich, please send it to me. That would be so great if this worked out.
That would be great.
Right? So, final question I want to ask you. You've been lovely to chat with.
Thank you. Likewise.
Tell me, for, you know, new comedians coming up, and I know the world's a little bit different, but, you know, what advice do you have for them as far as, like, sticking to it? You know, you mentioned that in the class that you had, only two people, you know, continued to do it. What do you think, you know, gave you the stick-to-itiveness? Like, what could they do to keep it going?
I think that if they really love it and that they really want to do it, like, they should probably try not to listen to too much advice from anybody, like from any one person. Like, that's what I kind of did. Like, I always got advice from people, whether I asked for it or not. But the thing to keep in mind is you can still learn, from most of it. You just have to figure out which to keep and which to throw away. So, listen to people, listen to their stories, you know, listen to them talk or whatever, and then know what not to listen to. Because as much as I love my friends and stuff too, like, you know, there's going to be points in time that the people that you know who are the closest to you might have some other suggestions. And I would say F that and keep and keep doing what you know you want to do. Because all you have to do is put in the time. Like, in my head, I dropped out of college because I thought 10 years investing in myself in something I like is going to be worth more to me than 4 years being in debt at the end of it and not being thrilled with the job at the end.
Sure.
So that was
yeah.
my, yeah, that was kind of what kept me going, was like, oh, I keep, you know, I just set markers for myself. And I was like, if I'm better, if I get a little farther here, if I get a little farther there, I'll keep going. And I always got better and I always got a little farther.
Totally. Plus, something that my husband and I have said since, you know, we work in conventions, so we're hanging tight. But like, if you can hold on, like if you can hang tight right now, people will drop off, you know, like people are going to quit. So like,
yeah.
when big events start happening again, just be the guy that's still there. Like, hi, I'm available. What's up?
Yeah.
You know,
well, and
like, that's such an important part. Like, and even
yeah.
I'm so inspired by your just making phone calls thing. Like, what? You can just
yeah.
call people and ask them and they'll go, yes, that's insane.
Yep. Yeah. And that's another thing too, is like, I'm not, you know, don't be pushy about it, but be the person who's not afraid to go, you know, hey, I want to do this. Is there any way I can do it? Because if they say no, then they say no, and you move on to the next thing. Like, even when I'm at, like, when I would go to do clubs on the road, and when I was doing it for the first time, in my head, I would go, okay, well, I'm going to have as much fun as I can performing my material and having fun with the audience. And if they have me back, they have me back. And if they don't, they don't. And no club is going to make or break you. There's nobody anymore that's going out to these venues that's going to make you a star. So it's all about getting better at what you do and learning from mistakes.
Totally.
And also one more piece of advice too, is you have to decide when you're going to move up in the career, especially if you're a comedian, because very rarely is somebody going to say, I want to pay you more money for what you do.
Mm.
So when I was an MC and I wanted a middle, I said I was going to middle. And then when I was just a middle, and I wound up headlining because, one, I should have been headlining long before I started. But I just never, it was something, I put it on a pedestal. It was something super special to me that only certain people I knew got. And that was it. And it was the wrong way to think about it. And then I started headlining because I literally was like, I'm not making enough money and I don't want to quit doing stand-up. So I need to gather all my material and start closing shows. And then I did it. And that was it. And there were some rooms I couldn't work anymore because they were like, you're not headlining. And then there were other ones who were like, yeah, absolutely. And that was that. And then the other rooms who said no were like, yeah, you can come headline. And then that's how that works. So I had to decide when.
Yeah. It's about valuing yourself and your own skills.
Yeah. So, yeah, I could have said all that by saying what you just said in three words.
No.
You're like, let me sum that up for you so that way nobody gets bored.
No, not at all. No, I was just thinking about like how people don't value themselves.
It's a hard thing to
think. Yeah, we just think, oh, I don't deserve it. I haven't done this. And then, you know, you get the angry older guys who are like, you haven't earned it. And you're like, maybe he's right. He's not right.
Yeah, exactly.
He's,
right.
he's mad because
like,
he's still here with you.
Yeah, yes, exactly. It's a fine line to walk too, because you're like, you don't want to be, you know, be humble, and be humble, be nice. But also value yourself. So, you know, not to be rude or anything like that, but know like, hey, look, you know, I think I'm probably worth more than this. So, you know, I'm going to figure out another way to do it. Because everybody who like is famous or doing a thing, not saying they're not talented, they totally are, but people never talk about how lucky they are for the most part. And a lot of that plays in. I've had people help me. I've had, like people who've been started before me, you know, give me the right information or let me, you know, open for them at clubs and stuff. And that's invaluable.
Absolutely. John, thank you so much for being on the podcast and sharing your stories. This has been a great conversation.
Thanks for having me. This has been a blast. So thank you. And now we can start recording.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.